Welcome to Sacred Realms, a podcast where two rabbis explore the intersection of Jewish wisdom, science fiction, and fantasy. In this episode, we will answer a she'elah, the question of the month, talk about what we've been watching or reading lately, noting any Jewish connections. Then we'll do a deep dive into our main topic, and for our final segment, From the Geniza, we will dust off one or two of our favorites from the past and see what we find there. From the pages of ancient texts to the realms of imagination, let's explore the wonders of Jewish lore and sci-fi fantasy. Welcome to Sacred Realms.
This month, we'll be talking about the intersection of fan fiction, people creating new stories and art based on their favorite bodies of fictional work, and Midrash, the rabbis filling in the gaps and creating new stories based on their favorite body of work, the Hebrew Bible. Why do people expand upon these literary worlds? So let's start with our question of the month. Lindsay, if you were to write some fan fiction, what story would you want to add to, extend, or even rewrite with a whole new version? What would you pick?
Maybe you should go first.
I am happy to go first. I often think that like my go-to would be Star Wars, but I've actually never wanted to do that. I really only watch the movies and TV shows. And even with when I had Star Wars toys, I only wanted to recreate the movies I had seen. So I never really wanted to add stories myself to Star Wars. But the world I do want to play in is Avatar, the Nickelodeon series. I love that world. I love the different time periods that are already nicely fleshed out. I would love to create specifically a fan fiction version of the Avatar after Korra. Korra is a waterbender who is the Avatar, set in like a 1920s, 1930s version of their world, roughly analogous to ours. The next Avatar would likely be in a nuclear or information age and would be an earthbender who might be a metal bender. And I would want to see that Avatar dealing with either metal bending as it pertains to networks and electrical systems or nuclear power. I think that would be fantastic. So that's what I would love to write.
This is interesting for me because it's also raised another question that we can kind of add to our main topic, maybe, which is what is the relationship of the comedic or spoof genre to original creations? Because I used to come up with a lot of those with my friends when I was a teenager. And I think that tends to be how my mind operates or works is more, you know, picking up on things in a way in order to exaggerate elements of it and poke fun at it a little bit. In terms of something that I want to do, nothing is coming to mind. But I did totally come up with this whole thing that was written in the form of a screenplay based on 1984, but putting it in the context of my public Texas high school and, you know, noting the parallels between the controlling, oppressive regime operated by Big Brother with the very controlling regime, controlling student movement and behavior in post 9/11 Texas public school. So that was fun. There were fun parts of it too, right? I'd have to go back and read this. I really want to reread 1984 now and see what I think, because it really left an impression on me as a high school student. But there's a scene where like the main characters meet in a field for their romantic interlude. One of the protagonists was actually a calculus textbook.
Okay. It's like an actual textbook?
Our requirement in our schools. All books needed to have a cover. Like an additional cover, either constructed out of cardboard or something else, or you would be fined. Basically, everything that could be an opportunity for some kind of pen in our school system was. There had been an evolution prior to the creation of this screenplay about the books needing to cast off the shackles of their oppression in the form of the required covers. Thus was born Wendell, the calculus textbook.
He sounds lovely.
Unfortunately, this was never made, and I don't have any copies of the screenplay because this was before cloud-based everything. And so it was probably saved locally on someone's hard drive.
You'll have to recreate it from memory. I think comedy and satire is an interesting subgenre of fan fiction. I do know that George Lucas's favorite fan film was one that I saw as a kid on HBO, which was Hardware Wars. Somebody made a 10-minute long trailer of a super low budget Star Wars where every ship is a home appliance. It was extraordinarily silly. It's on YouTube. Go watch it. Apparently the maker of it threw a VHS tape over the Lucasfilm wall and never knew if George Lucas ever got a copy of it. And then years later in an interview said that Hardware Wars was his favorite fan. There's an homage to that fan film in The Last Jedi by Rian Johnson. In the scene where Rose and Finn and the hacker break into the lead Imperial ship. Yep. The opening shot is of an iron coming down to crest an Imperial uniform or First Order uniform. And the Millennium Falcon in Hardware Wars was an iron. It was a very deep cut. And to my nerdy parent pride, my eldest, Hadar, she immediately got the reference. And I was just so proud. So nice comedy fan fiction there.
You know, just reminding me of how many things of the style of comedy that I tended to enjoy, you know, particularly in my teenage years. I watched a lot of Mel Brooks. And a lot of it is satire, right?
Right. Young Frankenstein as a comic fan version of Frankenstein.
And also Monty Python, even before I started thinking about Mel Brooks, which I started thinking about when you were talking about Star Wars fanfic or fan films. Made me think of Spaceballs, from that to like other things.
Yeah, their fanfic version of the King Arthur story, their fanfic version of The Life of Jesus and Life of Brian. And for those listening, you can drop us an email with your answer to this month's question, or you can propose a question of the month for an upcoming episode. Send us any of those emails to sacredrealmspodcast@gmail.com. So, Lindsay, what have you been watching or reading lately?
So, what I have been reading lately is a web comic called Rialta. And basically, the premise of this is that the constellations, astrological signs, however you want to understand them, when at the beginning of the world, descended from the skies to bless humanity with magic according to their date of birth. And so, all of humanity are reflective of what those astrological signs are. Taurus, for example, they have horns like a bull and ears that look like a bull, various other things. Apparently, there are 14 kind of worthy people who are called the Rialta who receive a special star that allows them to be able to receive prophecies and gives them a special kind of power so that they will be able to defeat the Fae, who in this series are evil beings who want to torment humanity. But over time, I'm still in the series finding out kind of what happens. Magic has become illegal. Certain of the groupings seem to no longer exist or have gone into hiding. We'll find out. Because they're not able to practice magic, the Fae are getting stronger. All of the people are increasingly afraid and isolated. And the Rialta, who they are, who they might be, is unknown. Seems to be a world in which gender identity is much more fluid. That is built into the characters from the outset. There's no assumption on the part of the characters about what people might identify as until they share how they identify. So we'll see what happens. It's recommended by a friend. And I've started finally watching the second season of Good Omens on Amazon Prime, but haven't gotten very far into that yet. And it's yet again a reminder that I probably should read those books. Really enjoyed season one. So we'll see what unfolds there. And because I was really feeling like I wanted some comfort watching, I wanted to rewatch, and I've been thinking about this for some time, but I just started rewatching series on Netflix, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. I wasn't watching it for this reason, in connection with our topic for this month about reworkings of material. The character of Sabrina, the teenage witch, appears originally in the Archie comics series, has these different features. She's blonde, average teenager, high school student at Greendale High, because in the TV series, they're in Greendale. The interesting evolution of the Archie comic book universe from the original series that are based on around like this group of friends in Riverdale High, different characters end up getting spin-offs, Sabrina being one of them. There was also the TV series from the 90s, maybe into early 2000s, starring Melissa Joan Hart as Sabrina. This was a reboot of the comics under Archie Comics imprint that was Archie Horror. I'm not normally a horror fan, but I like things that have to do with magic. They riff on a lot of the different characters in Archie, and that was the origin for the Riverdale TV series, which I've not watched all of, but it's the main characters are Archie, Betty, Veronica, Jughead, all of the classics, and is informed by this horror retelling or creating new narratives involving the characters. But let's make it really dark. The Netflix series, in a lot of ways, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, is less dark than the comic books are.
Oh, why?
I don't know, because I read the comic book. I think I started the series, figured out that it was based on comic books, went back, read the comic, finished the series, so I'll see what I think about it. But yeah, it's very interesting to me to compare this take on it to the 90s TV series that was for primetime TV, bright, happy. And I think that captures kind of the spirit of the original characters in the comics series. But this takes in a different direction. It's like, no, like, Sabrina's aunts are actually a part of a witch cult that involves being in service to Satan, the Dark Lord. And Sabrina, in episode one, is gearing up for her dark baptism, which will take place in the woods on her 16th birthday under the eclipse and involve her signing her name in the Dark Lord's book, which she is now having mixed feelings about because once she goes through this, her primary concern is about leaving her friends at Greendale High School if she now has to go to this special boarding school for young witches and warlocks. Because you can never, in any series, be a witch or wizard or warlock teen with supernatural abilities and stay in your own school. You always have to go to a school that is a boarding school, most likely, where you will learn how to engage your talents or your gifts. So that's where we are. I've just rewatched episode one. And so I'm curious to see how it's all going to unfold. It's great. I like it a lot. Okay, what about you? What have you been watching?
I watched the first season of Fallout on Amazon Prime. I have not played any of the games, but you didn't need to. It was well designed to where you just get plopped into this set in the 200-year from now future where humanity is living in underground shelters after a nuclear war. And you begin to see what life is like in a certain shelter, a neighboring shelter, and life on the surface itself. It's all about how does humanity survive after a nuclear war? What kind of society might emerge after a catastrophe? Can humanity create a capsule to reboot the best of human civilization? Is it even possible to then either merge with or take whatever has emerged organically on the surface? That's one of the big questions. The main character who finds herself growing up in this idyllic underground shelter, goes to the surface where it's dog eat dog. Can somebody maintain the norms of their home civilization, the place where there is no civilization? And can she maintain herself? Will she bend? Will she adapt? That's one of the big questions that it asks. I thought about the Pirkei Avot teaching, the place where there are no people, try to be a person, or the place where there are no mensches, try to be a mensch. She's trying very hard to be a mensch and not doing so well so far. I've been watching The Bad Batch, the most currently concluded Star Wars show. It ended its 3-season run, focusing on the early years of the Empire and specifically on Emperor Palpatine's Operation Necromancer, which we assume is his project to clone people who can be force sensitive, ostensibly making a new body for himself. It's never said explicitly, but we're kind of assuming that's how Palpatine returns. It focuses on this one batch of clones who are all experiments, including Omega, who is the last clone. She's actually a female version of Jango Fett, unaltered, except that she is female. Not that she can use the Force, but she's Force sensitive. It really does beg the question with Palpatine, how far does somebody go to preserve their own life? And when do you say that's the natural end? Also, with the clones being programmed from birth to be good soldiers, how much of one's personality is nature versus nurture? Can you overcome your genetic predispositions, or are you doomed to that fate? It kind of goes into some of those interesting questions. X-Men 97 just finished this morning as of this recording, and I never watched the old series. Basically, it's...
You never watched...
I never watched the original X-Men 97. Marvel picked up where it left off almost 20 years ago, trying to, I think, kind of connect it to where the MCU might be going. And the big question, can humanity tolerate or even respect mutants living in their midst? They make the parallels very clear between mutants and Jews and the Romani during the Holocaust, and also between LGBTQ people and mutants. You know, any difference, you know, will it be tolerated or rejected and feared? It was quite good. The stakes are real in that show. And then I was watching a show called Evil. It's on Netflix, seasons 1 and 2. You're following a team of assessors hired by the Catholic Church in New York City to determine if people need exorcism. So the team is a soon-to-be ordained priest named David, a psychologist whose name is Kristen, and a scientist named Ben. The latter two are brought in to assess, is it a mental health issue or is it a scientific explanation for the possession? It's a lot of horror, you know, deal with the main question, what's the nature of evil? Is it an internal or an external force? Do we grapple with our own internal, you know, demons metaphorically or literally? Are you actually fighting off demons? Demons are a big part of it, and they kind of ride the line between demons being real or imagined for a lot of it. So that's what I've been watching lately and trying to find the big questions that they and Judaism share, which are everywhere. So now on to our main topic this month, fan fiction and midrash. So what is fan fiction? What is midrash? And how do they relate to each other?
So what is fan fiction? Fan fiction are stories, but maybe we can also talk about fan art and other kinds of creations too that are created by fans of a particular book, movie, TV series, comic series, any number of things that draw on the character, setting, story of the original creation, use that to create new stories.
I heard that fan fiction in the modern sense might have begun with Sherlock Holmes stories.
That with meaning people writing their own stories about
the Sherlock first Holmes. Noticed example on a large scale, I suppose, was when Sir Conan Doyle began writing Sherlock Holmes stories, people began to write their own stories about Sherlock Holmes. Like, it drew people in to the genre, the characters, so quickly that fan fiction emerged very soon after they began appearing in the press. And that's what I pointed to as one of the first examples of modern fan fiction, which it's also one of the most redone properties that I've seen. So that's the first modern fan fiction. And then Midrash is, I guess I should say, when we say Midrash, we really mean in this case, Midrash Agadah versus Midrash Halakha, meaning rabbinic commentary on narrative versus rabbinic commentary on law. Although both are a kind of, I will say, fan fiction, both are forms of commentary. I think we're talking primarily today about rabbinic commentary on the narrative portions of the Hebrew Bible. Would you agree with that? Or should we include Midrash Halakha?
Right. And I would say it's like, ask if commentary is the word that we want to use, because I think.
Yeah, I hear you on that.
There are a lot of different valences of the word Midrash in and right. of itself.
So I think today I'm going to define Midrash as a rabbinic narrative that fills in a gap in the biblical narrative or adds in a whole new narrative into the biblical canonical narrative. So Midrash are larger bodies of work than that, some of which are legal, some are narrative, and does to me feel like actually an older version of fan fiction, in that the rabbis compelled to keep adding to, in some way, the biblical narrative for their own purposes. And what those purposes are, we'll talk about. What doesn't inspire us as human beings to do this?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of our questions. Like, what inspires people to draw on or continue expand on a particular story or narrative? Because we're seeing that impulse is common both between the rabbis reworking or expansion of biblical narrative and with the tendency of people who become fans of particular kinds of works to want to engage with those stories further. Related to that, are there certain qualities of a story that tend to invite or encourage people to engage with it in that kind of way?
That's a great question. You're asking, I think, a qualitative question, like what kind of story is it? And I was thinking of it more relationally, like how people relate to the body of material, but that might be relating to it in that they relate to bodies of work that are of a certain quality.
I think they're related to me in that way but maybe it is a question to ask. But clearly there are some works that have drawn larger numbers of people into wanting to engage with them in those kinds of ways.
Right.
What is it?
Compelling characters with compelling connections to others in settings that are evocative and provide a backdrop where there's more story to be told. I think it has to do with compelling characters for me. Compelling characters. Fleshing out more about who this person is, what their motives are, what their background is, putting them in other situations and imagining how would they respond in this scenario or this other situation. Is there anything other than characters that you think draws this kind of creativity?
So I think to me, this actually speaks to why we're doing this podcast and some of our conversations that we've had about what it is that we're doing here and what stories are interesting and compelling. That it's not only about characters. For me, I mean, I think it's also the themes that are engaged. Like, there's something about these are stories that speak to really core, important questions and aspects of life that are going to touch a lot of people and that are going to invite people to connect with it, because I think that's a story that's more likely to inspire people to want to engage. And you can engage those kinds of questions more compellingly when you have characters that resonate. But I think, well, maybe that's a question too. What makes a character relatable. Maybe we can't really separate these things out. Maybe the narrative is driven and is compelling when you have characters who are engaged in a story that involves exploration of the deeper issues of what it means to be a person.
One thing that makes for me that makes a character relatable, and this is true in Torah or in any of the other realms we've been thinking about, are that the characters are archetypes, meaning I can see people that I know, including myself, in the people that are in the story itself. I can see the cast of characters in my life in some way in the cast of characters in the narrative itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the big themes are clearly, you know, I'll go to Star Wars, the big themes of good and evil and the journey and adventures and trying to do the right thing, fighting and abuse of authority, all relatable. And I can be able to see myself in those characters and the people in my life in those in a strong way. Like, who is my Obi-Wan Kenobi? Who has been a mentor? Companions you meet along the way who are on the journey with you. Who's my Ron and Hermione and Harry? If I am one of those three, who are the others? My close circle of friends, and what kind of role do they play in supporting and challenging me?
I would have to think about this more, the degree to which archetype play into my connection with characters. And I'm sure they do, right? Those archetypal roles are certainly present in most narratives. I think for me, what I was thinking of that makes characters compelling is them being flawed. Mm. One of the things that I find so compelling about the Hebrew Bible is that even like the heroes, the people, including Moshe, Moses, who is the greatest prophet who ever lived, who is considered to be of utmost humility, mess up and aren't perfect. I can relate to that. I can't ever relate easily to these sort of characters that are on this higher pedestal, can't, you know, beyond reproach. Or even if you see things that seem flawed with them, or like, okay, well, we can't really criticize that character because they are holy, or there must be some possible explanation for their actions that seem terrible, even because they are on this other plane. The Hebrew Bible itself and later Jewish tradition sometimes engages in apologetics around characters, but has a strong tendency to recognize them for what they are, of having a mixture of both good and less good qualities. There are times when people have to deal with consequences of choices that they make. To me, that makes a much more compelling, relatable, and interesting story, because we can all relate to the experience of having things that we struggle with, making choices, messing up, having to figure out what to do next as a result of that. To me, that's something that stands out in movies, TV shows, book series. That's how I recognize myself in characters often.
I relate to that as well, both in terms of the biblical narrative and in other realm narratives where the flaws are part of what makes them highly relatable. And certainly the rabbis, midrashim, on certain figures and their flaws, sometimes they will say, oh, no, it's not a flaw. You're just reading it wrong. They kind of bring to their reading of the character a way to, as you said, to gloss over or to reframe the flaw into actually being something that makes him actually more saintly. And that brings up the question, is that something that they do consciously or unconsciously? Like, how much of any creative individual's conscious decision-making or unconscious reading is brought into the creation of the fan fiction or the midrash? What's intentional, what's unintentional? Like, somebody might just, you know, feel compelled to write more stories, and are they aware of the way in which they relate to the stories and kind of what they bring to the narrative? Because for the rabbis, is this simply their unconscious, the way they feel compelled to tell a story, or are they making deliberate decisions to tell it a certain way? And I don't have an answer to the question. I'd like it to be conscious. I'd like them to be making conscious narrative decisions, but I really don't know how much they're consciously doing in terms of being provocative, subversive, or just making it relatable in a way that they're unaware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it can be hard to tease that apart. I think there are some things, and without sitting there going through a particular text and trying to like figure it out.
Right.
I mean, like for the rabbis, often something that's unclear in the text or a gap in the narrative that allows a space for someone to fill in the story. Like, oh, I want to understand, you know, why there here's this reference here and we don't know what they're talking about, or there's a really long gap in the timeline and I wonder what happened during that time. I think some of those kinds of questions that the rabbis engage with also motivate fan fiction creation too. It's like, oh, creating something that happened before the narrative picks up.
For sure.
A character's backstory, picking up on a small vignette that doesn't get a lot of elaboration in the original work and expanding that further, or developing a relationship between characters that doesn't get direct attention, but many people might have think is alluded to in the original work. Some of those are the definite conscious processes or end motivations. And I think there's also stuff informing what we do unconsciously, and that comes through in what our worldview is and what kinds of things we're going to emphasize or not or pick up on.
Aviva Zornberg refers to rabbinic midrash as the rabbis reading their subconscious minds into the text. And I think she thought that they were not doing it overtly as a decision, but in their desire to read the text, that they cannot help but read their own time periods, issues into the text, which is compelling in and of itself and tells you what they're thinking about and what their concerns are. And I'm sure all fan fiction does that to some extent. People bring into it their own anxieties, worries, delights, questions, etc., into the fan fiction, because they're bringing something of themselves into it, almost by necessity. How could anybody create art that is detached from their own being?
What are all of the pieces or actors, entities that are involved in the creation of fan fiction? So we've been talking about the creators, the rabbis, writers of fan fiction, and what their conscious or unconscious motivations, inspiration might be. But yeah, now we can shift to talking about the source material itself. So how do fan fiction and midrash draw upon a canon of source material?
Right. One thing you mentioned is finding those gaps that drive the reader's questions. Two examples that came to my mind when you mentioned that a moment ago was at the very beginning of the story of the binding of Isaac in Genesis 22 is the phrase, after these things. And the rabbis are, what things? What happened? There's clearly missing details here. And then they create a whole range of possible narrative insertions about what led to the binding of Isaac. One of which is Isaac and Ishmael talking about who's more devoted to God. And Ishmael said, oh, when I was 13 years old, Isaac comes back, I would even sacrifice my entire life. And Ishmael said, would you now? And then the binding of Isaac ensues. And the other version was God and the adversary talking about Abraham, how Abraham has been neglecting God since Isaac's birth. Then God said, I bet he'd even give me his beloved son. And then the adversary says, you're on. And then the binding of Isaac ensues, inserting what prompted this horrifying scene to unfold. And the other one is in Return of the Jedi, when Luke first lights up his green lightsaber, everyone says, where did that come from? So yeah, get gaps like that, that just beg to be filled.
There has to be some kind of agreement about what constitutes the canon, or not has to be. There is, whether it is imposed by some kind of authority, either saying it's like, okay, this is the biblical canon, or we Marvel are the owners of the properties in our cinematic and comic universe, multiverse, and the ways that creators draw on a shared understanding or a shared knowledge base of what the canon is in order for their new creations to be intelligible, make sense, to other people who are familiar with that canon. In order for, you know, characters to be recognizable or the story to be plausible, a creator will want to make sure certain aspects of who that character is canonically are integrated in. And then how much do you play with, expand, or push beyond what the canon is might vary depending on the nature of the thing. Some people are clearly writing fan fiction that is trying to remain situated in the canonical narrative, the filling in the gap kind of story, right? Where nobody does anything that seems like a radical departure from anything that any character does canonically. Contrast that with other types of stories that might say, actually, we're going to have this character do something that might be unexpected or be an introduction of a very different element into who they are, what the story is, than had previously been introduced in the canon.
Mm-hmm. Like a real departure, something really outlandish.
Not even really outlandish, but particularly with fan fiction and kind of reviewing back over like some of the history of that. A lot of fandoms and fan fiction writing came out of Star Trek fandoms in the 60s and 70s. And this has been studied too, though there's some interesting things here too about who the writers are and what their identities are. But a really popular subgenre of that fandom and others subsequently has been romantic pairings between characters.
Yeah.
That not directly referred to in any way, or maybe it's being hinted at. The one that stands out here, right, is from which all fiction of this category takes its name, slash fiction, which was all began with Kirk slash Spock.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So the imagining, right, these are writers in the 60s and 70s, fans of Star Trek, who are imagining a romantic or sexual relationship between two male characters, which was probably not intended by the original creators.
No, probably not.
But people were creating a whole story around like the imagining them having a relationship. It might have seemed outlandish to many people in the 1960s because of just what the cultural context was. It could just be something that is not directly referred to in the canon.
I have heard a diabetic reading of Isaac where, oh, that's why he's gone blind and why he's not very mobile, because he has diabetes and his blood sugar is too high. I've heard also Isaac read as a developmentally disabled adult, which is why, if he's truly 37, the Binding of Isaac, why he's sort of like childlike. I've seen those readings of Isaac from contemporary readers who are reading into Isaac something that is not in the original, at least not intended by the original.
That in a category, though, of like, it's engaging the same kind of midrashic process of trying to offer an explanation for things that are based in the text, right? We're trying to make sense. Why is it that Isaac doesn't really speak to Abraham? Why is it that Isaac doesn't go to find a wife himself, and instead we have Abraham's servant sent? You know, all of those kinds of details that tend to be the kind of thing that like motivate rabbinic midrash creation too. And I think in some cases with fan fiction that happens, right? Like particularly with relationships where they're like, oh, is there something being hinted at here in the way that these two characters are interacting that could be best explained by them having this relationship that has not been fully explored in the canon?
I think a lot of rabbinic midrash as fan fiction, if they want to add in a narrative to fill the gap, they often will draw from other narratives in the Hebrew Bible as a template to fill the gap. So the God and the adversary talking about Abraham, they draw that from God and the adversary talking about Job. In other words, oh, where does God test somebody? Like God is testing Abraham? Oh, Job. Let's then lift that kind of scene and let's recreate a scene about Abraham that makes sense in this gap. Sort of like taking one biblical narrative, cueing to the way in which the biblical narrative works. If it's in the canon somewhere, it could happen somewhere else, and we can use a narrative from A to fill in a gap in B.
What that does also is like make it feel more coherent, right, with the rest of the canon. So like depending on what the goals are for creators, is the goal to try to make something that feels believable within the narrative, or is it a different goal or motivation? It's the goal to explore and have fun. This ties another question that we had about authorship and fandoms being supported by original creators or not, or what the relationship ends up being between original creations and the thinking about the ways that various properties have been rebooted or recreated or reinterpreted over time, even by the companies that own them. All the different interpretations of Superman and Spider-Man, and how many different reboots of Spider-Man have we had at this point? And what I was talking about earlier with the Archie comics, right? Yes, it is somebody working within the structure of Archie comics, but it's almost like them writing fan fiction about Archie that actually takes as a starting point doing something that completely departs from the canon in important ways, right? Now we're going to imagine there are supernatural elements that were not here. And that are like forms of fan fiction that engage in those kinds of ways too, right? The canon is a bunch of teenagers going to high school together in this town, and it's all about their interaction and relationships and them doing normal kinds of things. But, you know, the Archie horror series are like, well, what if everyone turned to zombies? What if Jughead is a werewolf? What happens then? What if Veronica is a vampire and goes on a rampage, right?
So the canon are those things that are immutable and then playing with what is variable.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So in the recent Sony animated film Across the Spider-Verse, the second of the three, they even talk about canonical events. Every spider person in the multiverse has certain things happen to them. Like a relative will die that is going to inspire them to accept their great responsibility because of their power. Mm-hmm. That it has to happen. If it doesn't happen, everything falls apart. In the Marvel What If series, there are certain events in history that must happen across the multiverse because they always happen.
There are these sort of like fixed points, or this idea of there being a cyclical pattern, like the spider person has to have X, Y, and Z things happen to them. Like things will repeat themselves in certain kinds of patterns and ways, biblical to me, right? This idea that like that there will be a person and they will have the X, Y, and Z kinds of things happen, or like this is the arc of history and these kinds of events are going to happen, not just, you know, biblically. You see that kind of a trope appear in a lot of science fiction and fantasy works too, that it's like the sort of like chosen person. It's like this thing has, you know, person has been predicted or preordained that they're going to have X, Y, and Z things happen. It almost feels to me like the properties themselves have kind of taken on this quality of rewriting and reinterpreting. We're going to take this thing and imagine as it, you know, what happens if it's different, or we're going to make this character and we're going to change the well-known character who has been worked with for decades, but now we're going to restart the series and maybe change the backstory. We might change core parts about their identity. And I'm wondering what the relationship might be between like fan fiction and that. It almost feels like, is there sort of this self-referential culture that gets created? And this, I think, goes to the question about the relationship between source material, creator, and audience. I think particularly in the world of like the comics world, like people who end up making comics are the reason they do it. They're often inspired because they're readers and enjoyers of those comics. And sometimes they might be the fans. And then when the fan becomes the official creator, then what happens?
Professional.
Then they
fan
might
fiction.
Be, oh, now I actually have the ability. I could create my fan fiction, except now it's given the canonical sort of stamp of approval.
Right. The professional fan fiction author.
Yeah.
Becomes the rebooter. Yeah. I think of J.J. Abrams, who did the 7th and 9th films in the Skywalker saga. He grew up like I did, like you did, loving Star Wars. Now he's directing. He clearly is a fan who grew up loving it and wanted to, happy to then create more. And definitely right. used a lot of very hewing close to the source material approach when doing the seventh film, you know, for better or for worse.
And it right. makes me think of the rabbis being similar in that way, right? Whatever layer of the interpretive process we're engaged in now does not have the same level of status as like early rabbinic midrashim. But, right, there are people who become film directors or comic book writers and creators or authors who are drawing on the things that they love. I mean, the rabbis are doing the same thing. They create the stories that they create. They were motivated to be the kind of people who are immersed in this enough that they can then create those stories.
Well, I guess we should differentiate between the fan fiction midrashic process, which is never going to stop, versus what is canonically true. Mm-hmm. And at some point, a line is drawn or a fan fiction is incorporated into something that is canonical. Or modern midrash becomes canonical through popular assent. I don't know. Like, there's
right, yeah.
The process is never going to stop happening. But what's in the canon and not in the canon, that's, I think, a fuzzy, fluid thing. It feels corporate to some degree today in terms of, you know, sci-fi fantasy. And Jewishly, I don't know who decides. You know,
right.
closed. Authors of contemporary midrash don't think it's closed, but more traditional people might say, well, that's very cute, but it has no standing.
We were having a little bit of a conversation about this, too. There is a self-conscious awareness in Jewish culture that even things that have become well accepted and are a part of the official interpretive tradition, are they're not considered to be on the same level as the Tanakh, right? So we have collections of major works that engage with Jewish law, of commentaries, all of these things that are a part of the Jewish bookshelf that's been widely accepted. But the term canon is not used in the same way with regard to those. I think the only thing that determines whether something is widely accepted is a part of the official conversation. It just has to do with time and use. You only know retroactively whether something becomes important. There's probably lots of works that are still preserved, but maybe weren't as widely read. Didn't Yosef Karo know when he's putting together the Shulchan Aruch that it's going to become as authoritative as it has been?
Probably not. Probably
right.
not.
Right. You can't know that until lots of people have adopted this.
Centuries later, it becomes clear.
We were talking a little bit about experience that you had with someone from a more traditional background, Jewish background, who was having a hard time, you were saying, with like the idea of like creatively interpreting things, because for them, at least for this one individual and their understanding, like there was a set of official midrashic interpretations, and that going beyond those was not kind of like within possibility for them. And I think this idea of there being like hierarchy between, you know, the rabbis of yore and their ability to read the text in a faithful way that sometimes, you know, in traditional contexts, later generations are sort of, you know, assumed to be on a lower level and therefore not capable of contributing at the same level.
The descent of the generations. Each generation becomes less and less worthy of adding right. anything meaningful to the canon.
Depending on how immersed in that kind of a way of thinking you are, like, then yeah, you're not going to think that anything anyone writes in the 20th or 21st century can ever attain the same level of rabbinic midrash, even if someone is engaging in a very similar process. But still, even in the traditional communities, right, there's always a role for more interpretation in the realm of Jewish law. And also, if we didn't think interpretation had any meaning or significance or needed to still happen, then no one would ever give like a Dvar Torah in shul, in synagogue.
Right, right.
Like that's what you're doing. Like there, people are coming up with new interpretations or their take on it or their riff on it. They're going to call it that way, that or not.
right? So the process is unending and necessarily so, especially in Jewish settings, but probably in fantasy and sci-fi, because there's always going to be that desire to see yourself in the narrative and expand upon it and tell more stories in that world because it's meaningful and delightful. So let's talk about the relationship between the fandom writing material and, by analogy, Jews writing Midrash, the creators of the source material, which in the case of Midrash would be those who maintain the canon.
The analogy that was coming to mind for me between the Jewish stuff and pop culture was, you know, okay, you're the creator. Maybe you came up with the story, you're the writer, but then the company that owns the rights to all of this also has perspectives that they're weighing in on. So I'm kind of thinking about the parallel here as being Revelation. That's God. And then there's the community writ large who has become the arbiters of what's in and out over time.
Right. So they are a kind of gatekeeper for what's in the canon, what's out of the canon. We have a discussion in the Talmud, which books are problematic, but find their way in. Some books are out, like the books of Maccabees. So there is the gatekeeping canonical process. And there is at some point, I guess, with any organization who is gatekeeping what literature being produced is official or unofficial, there is that interplay. So how does that work with fan fiction? How does that work in a Jewish Midrashic context?
With the Midrashic context, as we were talking about, some of this only becomes clear after time has passed. Right? People have continued to respond to the original source material and respond to responses to the original source material, whether that's Midrash or commentaries or Shelot u'Tshuvot, asking halachic questions and answers about different things. It seems like we can only really know in retrospect what has become kind of official accepted interpretations or part of the corpus of Midrash or commentary or perhaps even a new genre that we've not yet created a term for yet. Once we see that people are reading it, engaging with it, continuing to use it, but you don't actually know necessarily in the moment whether something is going to take hold and become influential. And that's true for other kinds of innovation and novelty that's emerged over time in Judaism, whether that's kinds of schools of mysticism, Siddut. All of those were quite significant departures and new ways of engaging with source material and focusing on what's actually important that were new at the time and that eventually became widespread. But you wouldn't necessarily have known that in the moment. The ones that don't end up becoming officially adopted or that are later actively suppressed or identified as being heretical.
Part of the gatekeeping comes from places of education. What are they teaching? So the school is pushing certain books or limiting certain books in the curriculum that'll create one kind of canon. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, what rabbis do from the pulpit, the things that they bring in, which can expand what people hear in the pews, as it were. Not that those are canonical, but they're getting used and they're getting mm-hmm. some traction. Books of Musar were not in the canon, and now it's coming back into vogue, being rediscovered, new editions, new translations, new commentaries mm-hmm. on them.
Which communities have centered them is changing. Like I would say there's a similarity in my mind. Like I've also noticed, particular with Musar, an interest in that among non-Orthodox Jewish communities, like really having a resurgence. I mean, in the same way that I would say parallels, you know, interest in Chassidut among Orthodox Jews and then interest in Jewish mystical texts and taking them seriously. Whereas, you know, the conservative and probably reform movement, I'm less, you know, immersed in their, you know, in how this has changed over time. Like, but, you know, have exerted a lot of effort for most of the 20th century in trying to downplay any kind of like weird mystical elements that are very, very clear and apparent in our liturgy, for example. But now there's been this like re-embracing of that, like, no, actually, let's just own that this is a part of our tradition. the things that are integrated and have been present in widely accepted Jewish practice over time, but which elements are highlighted or get downplayed shifts over time too. And then there's just these moments when there's a re-engagement with certain aspects. And then, you know, suddenly like these things that had been sidelined among certain communities for decades and sometimes centuries can now become, right, brought back.
So after Return of the Jedi came out, the author Timothy Zahn wrote a new Star Wars trilogy that was official George Lucas endorsed trilogy. It was called the Thrawn trilogy. It was the aftermath of Return of the Jedi. There were three books. And the main antagonist was Grand Admiral Thrawn, who was the next person with the authority to actually run the Empire as it is struggling to survive the rebellion. When Disney buys Star Wars, they say every single novel, in particular the Timothy Zahn novels, because they were like the most likely novels to become scripts, were all decanonized and called legend. And they said, we're beholden to none of it, but we have the right to pick and choose things that work for us as we create the new official Disney-owning Star Wars canon. And they did bring back Thrawn, for example, as the main antagonist post-Return of the Jedi. So Timothy Zahn is now writing more Star Wars novels, but in the official canon, because he's popular, the things that he does will attract more attention and more readers. And that, I think, runs the, I'm going to say risk, the likelihood of his earlier novels of becoming more read, more beloved, and more approaching canonical, or the pressure to take more elements from them and to work them into the canon somehow. Like, there's a huge push to bring in Mara Jade, who is Luke Skywalker's significant other. Like, bring her in somehow. To my point, so Jill Hammer, an author of Modern Midrash, who is a dear friend and colleague, she's written books of Midrash focused on women's stories called Sisters at Sinai. Really great stuff. Is that canonical? The more it gets read, the more likely it becomes more popular. And over time, who knows? She does other things as well that draw people to whatever she does. She did a commentary on Sefer Yetzirah, a mystical text, which is known to the rabbis, not widely known today, but she's making it more well known by her commentary on it. And she then shows you where this stuff appears in the liturgy, where these ideas pop up in old liturgy. So because she's doing it, Sefer Yetzirah is becoming more well known again. And people are now seeing that it's been here all along.
Mm-hmm. Right. And bringing it to a different community and audience that had previously been exposed to it. That's a super interesting example. I also read Sefer Yetzirah for the first time using her translation and commentary. In addition to that, she also is adding in new meditations and ways of engaging with the text as part of what she created. So that's adding an additional layer in as well.
Yes.
Once you see it, have the spotlight on it, it's like now everywhere I'm seeing references to Sefer Yetzirah and, you know, realizing the ways that this has been influential and has been studied by scholars for a long time, but that had not made its way into the consciousness of the bulk of like non-Orthodox. We've talked about this in a previous episode before, exploring this idea of at what point does a text become a religious one or a sacred text? What are the features that we're looking for? One of the things that we were talking about was, are people meaningfully orienting their life around this in a particular kind of way? For some of these works of sci-fi and fantasy and all of the literature and creation that's developed around them, that has become true. It's certainly a quasi-religious thing. I mean, it also gets into questions that I think people who are scholars of religion talk about, which is like, what makes something religious are things that we put in the category of like secular. In fact, actually share at least features with things that we identify as being religious. Gathering, sense of belonging and identity, ritual, that, you know, a sense of canon. And like, it's very interesting.
I'm really curious to hear your thoughts and talk a little bit more about the pieces of literature that are reworking biblical material and adding their own unique spin on it. It covers intertestamental literature, like the Book of Jubilees. There's a retelling of, I think, just Genesis, and the Patriarchal Testaments, which is Joseph's brother's story from their own deathbed points of view. They tell the Joseph story from as they experienced it, to things like Anita Diamond's The Red Tent, Zora Neale Hurston's Exodus narrative, Moses Man of the Mountain, which is the Exodus story told in 20s Black vernacular. Even Good Omens by Gaiman and Pratchett deal with a lot of biblical stuff. Joseph Heller has a David novel. Geraldine Brooks has Secret Chord, another David novel. And Yochi Brandes, who wrote two books. One, it's called Malachim Gimel in Hebrew, The Secret Book of Kings in English. It is a retelling of the story of Samuel, Saul, and David from Michal, King Saul's daughter's point of view, which completely subverts the pro-David narrative. The Secret Book of Kings, you are cheering on the North. And wait, you want the South to go stick it. I mean, you are, it subverts everything that the Book of Kings wants you to think.
That's really interesting.
It is an anti-David narrative. And she is Orthodox, from a scholarly family, a scholar in her own right, knows all the material very well, and writes a provocative countertext to Kings. Dear Shuni.
Right.
Modern Israeli scholars writing modern Midrash and classic forms in Hebrew, also available in English, and the Prince of Egypt. All of these things that are like taking the biblical material and doing fan fiction-y, Midrashic-y things to it. Mm-hmm. How do those all fit in this for us and for anybody?
Yeah, that's a good question. Before we started recording, you're talking a little bit about how Anita Diamond with The Red Tent was very insistent and emphatic on this not being Midrash. And what you took that to me, or understand, is not her not wanting people to assign religious import to it. When you were talking about Malachim Bet, the Secret Book of Kings, and sharing a little bit about the background of the author, which raised a question for me, which is, what role does intention play in this, in terms of whether we see this as just a fun piece of fiction imagining, or is there something that we would consider religiously serious going on? And does it matter? What's the space between drawing on this material and playing with it and imagining things and not making any kind of claim, or not trying to make a claim about the source material or interpreting in a certain way that would then influence anyone's understanding of it from a religious perspective? Is that even possible to do? Because somebody could read The Red Tent regardless of what the author's intention was and have it really influence their understanding of the story and the source material.
Right. So Yochi Brandes gets a little bit meta in the novel, and she writes in it that they are writing down these stories as they're happening, and they are using these stories to generate support for King David. That the narratives are happening in real time, like the written version happening in real time, and that she talked about the weaponization of narrative in the novel. Like, and Michal gets people to put in chronicles that a guy named Elchanan killed Goliath. David, a religious point is that we need to read our texts more critically, with an eye towards who's writing it, why are they writing it, who's the audience, what's the purpose of that actual piece of literature, which may have a religious value. I'm not sure to her community, but certainly to an audience, reading tech with a critical eye is clearly what she's inviting.
That's super fascinating. And I'm really curious to read this book now. I'm sure it would be super interesting to read in Hebrew, but it would probably take me a million years to try to read in literary modern Hebrew. It would be like a disaster. I'm like, I can read biblical Hebrew, Aramaic, cool, modern literary Hebrew would be more complicated. But what was coming up for me in like hearing about this was it sounds super subversive.
Yeah.
And I'm also thinking about the ways in which, you know, I do this too. It's like when you create something as fiction or poetry or some other kind of literary form, it gives you a lot more space to explore the possibility without saying I'm necessarily making a claim that has religious impact. Not doing that, but it's different for me to enter into this creative, imaginative realm to play it out and see and experiment with what this actually might mean, which is different than me getting up in shul and saying, okay, guys, this is my interpretation as a rabbi that I am laying down that I think is authoritative and correct.
Yeah, because Judaism exists in a multivocal, multi-narrative space where you can have multiple versions of one story coexist and there's no problem. One of my congregants was saying to me, oh, something about Mordechai. And I said, oh, Mordechai, by the rabbis, identified as Malachi, as the last prophet. And he went on, he's like, what? That makes no sense to him. So he went on Sepharia, did some reading. Is, oh, Malachi is also identified as Ezra. He says, what's right? I said, they're all right. That Malachi is both Ezra and not Ezra, and Mordechai and not Mordechai, and maybe Mordechai is Ezra or not, and that's all fine. And he was very unhappy with my answer because there's no one definitive way to read the text. And in fan fiction, similarly, relies upon multiple ways to tell one story.
Mm-hmm. And allowing this multiplicity of possibilities to coexist at the same time. When I give a divaratura or interpreting the story in a certain kind of way, always, I mean, it's very, very rare, I would say pretty much never do I come down on this is the right way to read and interpret this particular biblical narrative. Instead, the language that I'm most often engaging with is maybe we can read it this way, or what if we read this story through this particular lens, and then what possibilities does that open up? And I love those questions or those words as the framing for what we're doing, which is, you know, we're in the realm of the maybe. As we see in Midrashic texts themselves, Devar Oser. Like,
yeah.
What about, and here's another way, like here's another word, another interpretation, another possibility. And you might have a bunch of those in sequence edited together in one text that cannot both, you could not actually make coherent sense of the story. There are just different possibilities that are offered.
And then one thing I would say is, for me, I can enjoy Zora Neale Hurston's novel. I can enjoy Prince of Egypt. I can enjoy Orson Scott Card's Stone Tables and DeMille's Ten Commandments and still enjoy the original Exodus narrative with no problem. All of those tellings can totally coexist in my mind.
For a lot of people, when certain Midrashim or extra canonical interpretations of all kinds of stories become widespread, they actually end up influencing our reading of the text too. How many people have watched the Ten Commandments and then that's the image that they have seared in their brain when they actually go to study the text in the Hebrew Bible, and it's in its original, you just have Charleston Heston in your mind holding these tablets. And then reading the original text can actually become an act of subverting this culturally ingrained image about the order of events and how it's been. And I'm wondering if that applies also with works of original works once people have been immersed in the realm of fan fiction, right? The way that headcanon gets established. And you're like, I never can read this or watch this story the same way again now that I have read or interpreted. Like, I will see these or pick up on details or be more attentive to them in a way that I might not have before.
All right, I'm going to Star Wars out on two little things. One, in Princess Leia's holographic message to Obi-Wan Kenobi in the original Star Wars A New Hope, she begins the message General Kenobi and ends it with Obi-Wan, right? And it's a little weird. Like, it begins really formal and then it gets personal at the end. And Lucas did that for whatever reason. And in the Obi-Wan Kenobi series they just did, they show they have a backstory that is, of course, he didn't even imagine that, which kind of now explains how it begins formal, but it gets personal at the end. So it retcons the line beautifully. The other big one is so funny. So C-3PO, he's being bought by Luke's uncle to work on a moisture farm. And he says, "Oh, I used to work on a moisture farm just like this one." And cut to Phantom Menace, that C-3PO was sold to Lars years earlier and had his memory wiped. It's like, this looks familiar. So they retcon that. So they take that line and make it have a whole new significance later on.
That feels to me like a perfect parallel with the way that a lot of rabbinic midrash works, right? Picking up on one line, being like, well, here, you know, why did Leia begin with General Kenobi and end with Obi-Wan? Well, there was this whole other story. We're going to explain what the process was here.
Yeah, I thought that was just utterly delightful.
Yes.
From the Geniza, Prince of Egypt, which was on our minds. And I recently rewatched it before Passover this year. It came out when I was in rabbinical school.
Oh.
And Bert Vizgotsky talked about it with us, the process of advising for it and things that Jews wanted to be in there, things that Christians did, Muslims, that everybody could appreciate it as a text that they could all go see and get something out of for every faith tradition. So that was an interesting piece of it. How does it live in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I had the experience of initially watching this movie. I think it came out when I was in my early teens and before I was Jewish or had Judaism as a primary context for understanding the story. My previous context for the Exodus story really was the Ten Commandments, right? And later, you know, coming back to watch it with an appreciation for a lot of the Midrashim and Jewish interpretive lens that was brought in and incorporated into the way that they chose to tell the story made it more meaningful. And the being immersed in a way of reading the original stories that is very attentive to the detail of the text, I could notice and appreciate the ways that they like made choices about how to, you know, interpret it, right? The burning bush scene is one that stands out and is beautifully animated, showing you rather than telling you, as the text does, like, what does it mean to have a fire that doesn't consume the bush, right? And Moses interacting with this fire and what that looks like and is really beautiful. The scene of crossing the Red Sea creates is amazing. And you're, you know, also like the prominent role that's given to Miriam, the sister, Moses' sister in the movie, is something I was very drawn to when I initially saw it because of the way that, you know, female characters had not done star billing in some of the other popular tellings of this story, but that is faithful to biblical text, you know, Midrash as well, emphasizing her role as instrumental in saving Moses's life and being a prophetess and being a leader of the community in a meaningful kind of way. And, you know, the singing that goes on when they cross over, right? That way of bringing to life the biblical text that says that people broke out in song and that Miriam led the women. And they show that. Doing that.
One thing I loved about it that they added, and one thing I wish that they had included, I loved that Moses and Randis are close the whole time, despite everything. And I really wish the night of the Exodus, they had included the meal in some way. All they showed was people hovering in their homes in the dark, terrified of the angel of death, the mashrit. I wish they had included the eating of lamb on black bread with bitter herbs in some way. I guess this particular watching noted the lack of it that it was also a celebration, or I don't know, a celebration. There was also that event, which is also part of the 10th plague at night to balance out the fear. You know, can't do it all. The DeMille version does have that. Very clearly. But he doesn't really show Moses and Ramses as being close, more adversarial. I like that this version had them being really close and unwillingly adversarial. This, I really love that. That brought an emotional depth to the portrayal that I haven't seen other versions have.
That concludes this episode of Sacred Realms. Thank you for making time to listen, and we hope you come back to hear more. If you like this episode, please give us a shout out on social media, tell a friend, or leave us a positive rating or review. You can also listen to all of our past episodes wherever you find your podcasts. This episode was edited on Squadcast and edited using Descript. You can reach us at sacredrealmspodcast@gmail.com. May the Mefarshim be with you.